From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you up to date on the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Caleb Rodell, KUNR's Mountain West News Bureau reporter, Ruth Brown with Idaho Public Television, and Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday and Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year, Gemma.
Happy New Year.
Happy Friday.
Okay, so let's begin with an Idaho lawsuit. The lawsuit is Adkins versus Idaho. Some people may not be aware of this, but it centers around women who are seeking abortions during medically complex pregnancies. And I know, Ruth, you've been following this case. Can you begin by just basically filling us in about the case and then where it stands in the courts right now? Because there was a ruling last Friday in this.
There was, yeah. So the case is unique. This is a complaint that was filed back in September, and it involves four women who sought medical abortions in the state. It also includes two Idaho physicians and the Idaho Academy of Family Physicians, which represents several hundred physicians in Idaho. So what makes it unique is it's different than the Planned Parenthood lawsuit we saw earlier this year that went before the Idaho Supreme Court. And yes, on Friday, Judge Scott did issue an order. The Attorney General's office had filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit in its entirety, which Judge Scott declined to do. Judge Scott did narrow the claims that can come forward, though. The first is the women are seeking a judgment that would determine whether a physician may provide a pregnant person with abortion care when the physician determines basically that a pregnant person has an emergent medical condition that poses a risk to death or a risk to their health. Something that's important to keep in mind is in Idaho, abortion is almost entirely illegal. It is only legal if a woman's life is in danger rather than their health. And so I think a lot of folks get that confused, but a woman's life has to be in danger rather than having, you know, a variety of health conditions that could perhaps jeopardize a pregnant woman's well-being. The other claim that gets to go forward to trial is Judge Scott allowed it to move forward. The Idaho Constitution, backing up a little, I guess, Judge Scott allowed to move forward. The plaintiffs are seeking a judgment on whether the Idaho Constitution, by recognizing enjoying and defending life and, quote, pursuing happiness and securing safety are inalienable rights, by declaring that, does that entitle a woman to an abortion in emergency situations? The plaintiffs are leaning heavily on the securing safety phrase that is in the Constitution. And Judge Scott decided that this is different than the prior case we saw before the Idaho Supreme Court involving Planned Parenthood. That case sought what was, quote, a wholesale invalidation of the abortion laws. And this is a very narrow scope. This is involving pregnant women whose lives are in danger. Sometimes it's it can involve the fetus is not projected to survive. They have severe developmental disabilities, or the fetus is not going to survive, essentially. And the Attorney General made it clear that it is the policy of the state of Idaho that even if a physician has told a woman that fetus is not likely to survive after birth, abortion still is not an option in the state of Idaho. So that'll move forward to trial, and Judge Scott will have to hammer out those two claims. But that's kind of where we're at.
Okay, so if I'm understanding this correctly, Ruth, so A, the lawsuit was not vacated entirely. And then two, moving forward with these two claims, it goes really back to the Idaho Constitution, right? By recognizing what the Constitution says about enjoying and defending life, pursuing happiness and securing safety as inalienable rights. And that, so there is this argument that would say that if a woman does not have the right to an abortion in these emergency circumstances, that could be violating the Idaho Constitution.
Correct.
Okay.
And they're asking for these very specific terms because the Idaho Supreme Court did determine in the Planned Parenthood case that there is no constitutional right to an abortion in the state of Idaho. And so they're focusing on these very narrow subsets, such as securing safety if a woman's life is in danger.
Okay. So what happens next in the case then moving forward?
So the court date is set out quite a ways. It'll be, I think, October of 2024. It'll go to trial.
So a long way. Okay.
Yes. Civil litigation does not move quickly. But it's important to remember that this decision on Friday, Judge Scott allowing these claims to move forward, did not change anything. It didn't put a stay on any bills. So all abortion in Idaho remains illegal in the state of Idaho, with exceptions only for reported rape, reported incest, or the life of the mother.
Okay. I appreciate that update, Ruth. I think it's something that so many people may not be aware of, in particular because this these judgments came out, you know, last Friday when so many people were still on holiday break. So appreciate that update in that case. Rachel, I want to talk about another lawsuit, this one in regards to a security guard, the city of Boise and Boise police. Can you give us some background on this? And then what happened, earlier this week?
Yeah, so we've been talking about this altercation since last spring when the Boise Pride Festival happened downtown. Organizers who put on the festival contracted a security company to, just add increased security. There were also Idaho State Police there and Boise Police. But, you know, there was, as we know, lots of controversy around Boise Pride last year. So I think they were kind of expecting to need extra security. And a little background on what happened. This security guard, Charles Raydorf, he's from Caldwell. He was contracted to provide security. He noticed a protester holding up anti-pride signs, and he was actually in the venue, like within the fence of Boise Pride. And the security guard knew that this guy had been trespassing and was not welcomed by the organizers. And so he tried to get Boise police to remove him. And he says Boise police didn't help him. And then later he noticed that the man was getting a little, not so much physically violent, but, you know, was talking to vendors, kind of provoking them. And so he tried to remove the man himself, and he said they tripped over a sidewalk trying to remove him, and it kind of led to them squabbling a little bit. And later Boise police arrested Charles Raydorf, the security guard. He was acquitted of those charges, but all of this to lead to the security guard filing a lawsuit against the city and Boise police, saying that they were negligent and didn't help him when he needed help. And so that's kind of where we were before early last month. We just knew that he'd filed a lawsuit and was wanting to get some damages from the city. But just last month, the judge in the case found that since the city had contracted or had granted a permit to a separate entity to put on the Boise Pride Festival, they were not liable for any damages that happened. So I talked to the lawyer for the security guard, and he basically said that it was kind of a disappointment that the city could not be held accountable to what happened. But that's kind of where we are today with that lawsuit. It's seems to be the end of the Boise Pride security guard and protester altercation. But the lawyer says that they're exploring other options and may appeal the judge's decision.
Okay, but at this point, the judge dismissed the lawsuit with prejudice, which means that they can't refile the lawsuit, at least in Ada County, correct?
Yeah. They can't refile in Ada County. And I don't know where else they would go since this happened right in Ada County. So, yeah, not sure if there are other options, but, you know, the lawyer did tell me they were thinking about other options.
Okay. Dawn, let's talk public records. In particular,
my favorite.
Your favorite. Okay, but I have to say, Dawn, this is fascinating. I mean, it seems kind of like a soap opera. Talk to us about what's being alleged that certain employees at Boise State have done to keep documents from becoming public records.
Yeah, so Gemma, Boise Dev has been engaged with Boise State University for a number of years on public records and transparency. This first came to our attention. Folks will remember there was a big Garth Brooks concert at Albertson Stadium several years ago. Mm-hmm. And the school at the time, the news leaked, I guess is the best way to put it. A radio host at KBOI Radio said, "Hey, I'm hearing that Garth Brooks is going to come to town." And so that made some people kind of go, Michael Deeds, the Idaho Statesman, asked the spokesperson at the time for the school, like, "Hey, do you have a contract for Garth Brooks to come?" And the spokesperson said, "Nope, we have no contracts." And then we requested some records later, and sure a skip enough, they had a contract for Garth Brooks to come play. And the contract had been signed before the spokesperson falsely told Michael Deeds that. We wrote an opinion piece at the time about that. We don't write a lot of opinion pieces at Boise Dev. In fact, I think there's less than five since we started, and that was one. So fast forward several years. We've been engaged with Boise State on all sorts of public records issues. My wife is tired of hearing about it. we've resisted writing about it because some of it is a bit inside baseball for people.
Yeah.
This fall, we were made aware of a deposition that a associate vice president for the school gave in the Big City Coffee case. You'll remember that Big City Coffee opened and then fairly quickly closed a location in the Albertson Library at Boise State in a former Starbucks store. And there's a lawsuit underway that essentially says that the school acted improperly in forcing the closure of the Big City Coffee. And there's even that's up for discussion as to whether they were pushed out or left. Mm-hmm. That's not actually material to our story. What is material is that the deposition said that Boise State's Associate Vice President for Communication, Marketing, and Strategy, Lauren Griswold, took a file that had apparently positive information about Big City Coffee that had been named Big City Coffee and renamed it B space C space C. In the deposition, which, as you know, that those are serious matters and people are expected to tell the truth. The person who was testifying was asked, "Well, why would she name it B space C space C?" And the woman testified, "I believe it was for it not to be put forth in a public records request."
Wow.
She said that she couldn't find the document because when she searched Big City Coffee, it no longer came up. And she said further that she's been, quote, asked and told not to put things in writing at times because of public records requests and documentation. Now, in our experience in asking for public records in Boise State, and I have been told that Boise Dev asked for more public records requests from the university than any other source, which I don't think they think is a good thing. I personally think is positive.
We depend on you to do that.
They often do plain text searches. So if I say I want, you know, all emails about, the student union building, they're going to search and look for emails with that keyword in it. And so if I were to submit a public records request and say, I want all emails about Big City Coffee, they would search for Big City Coffee. They wouldn't search for B space C space C, most likely, particularly right. because BCC, as you might imagine, is also commonly used in emails because people blank hire and copy. And so it's a very common term and would potentially turn up thousands of emails. Whether that was the intent or not, I don't know, but certainly there is a coincidence there. We asked Boise State University spokesperson Mike Sharp about this. Our story ran in November, I should say. This is just the first time I've been on your show to talk about it, and thanks for giving mm-hmm. us a chance. Mike said that they couldn't, of course, comment on the, well, not of course, that they wouldn't comment on the deposition because it's a pending legal matter. Of course, there's no law that prevents people from talking about legal matters, but generally lawyers don't like you to talk to the media about right. lawsuits because it can cause problems. So, but they did say, they did answer some questions about procedures, and I want to read Mike's quote because I think it's important to include here. Boise State's attorneys provide general education on public records laws. Like all attorneys, Boise State's attorneys also provide legal advice to their clients, in this case, university employees, on specific matters, including the interpretation and application of Idaho's Public Records Act. Our attorneys do not direct employees to violate the law, nor do university administrators. The Idaho Public Records Act is pretty clear in its writing. It's extensive. There's a lot of exemptions to it. The preamble to that act says, quote, every person has a right to examine and take a copy of any public record of this state. And there is a presumption that all public records in Idaho are open at all reasonable times for inspection, except as otherwise expressly provided by statute. The code is clear. Tax dollars are being used. You, me, all your listeners in Idaho are paying taxes. It's the public's business, whether it's mm-hmm. Boise State University, the city of Boise, the governor's office, the Capital City Development Corporation, it doesn't matter. They are working for us. They are of us, right? And so you have a situation where it appears university officials are trying to keep documents away from the public. I'm not going to get into it here on the air, but we have a long list of other issues that we've encountered and that some other news outlets have encountered with Boise State. Marlene Trump, after our story went out, did a podcast with Kevin Richard of Idaho Ed News and was asked about this. And she noted on the podcast that she's engaged with me over the years, and I've tried to find a way forward to being a little bit more transparent in my view. And sort of reiterated that she couldn't talk about the lawsuit and that she does believe that her people are making a good faith effort to provide records. I don't know that I fully agree with that. I think that that's not always true. The challenge with public records is the person who makes the decision has an inherent conflict because their boss may not want it out. And the only recourse that we have as the public, and I look at myself as a journalist, not as some high mighty, like, oh, look at me, I'm a journalist. I look at myself as a representative mm-hmm. of the public. I do work so that lots of people can understand things, right? I'm your representative. Mm-hmm. And the only way for me to have recourse, if Boise State says, well, you can't have this because it's got this exemption that we think that it is for me to go to court, to Fourth District Court in Idaho. And that's expensive and it's time consuming. I'm a small business and I don't have unfortunately, the resources to sue a multi-$100 million enterprise like Boise State over public records. And so it leaves us little recourse when we believe that they're wrong. And in this case, we've stated it very publicly. I will acknowledge the irony that we're talking about this on Boise State Public Radio, but as Gemma notes, they hold the license but don't have editorial control of your airwaves. So I'm comfortable right. talking about it here.
Right. And I think it's important, Don, honestly, that people understand issues like this, because as we said in the beginning, public records, I mean, you can get into the weeds. A lot of people, you know, might just, you know, their eyes may glaze over. But as you said, you know, this is supposed to be about transparency in government entities. And that is what, you know, that's what you were doing in this case. And I want to say, people, if you want to read this article in its entirety, go to Boise Dev and do that. But do appreciate all of your reporting on this, Don.
Yeah, thanks.
So, Clark, I know you are in the weeds preparing for the start of this year's legislative session, which begins on Monday. Yesterday, we had our very own James Dawson on the program talking about his big takeaways from yesterday's legislative preview. But Clark, I know you were there as well, and I would love to know what stood out to you during that preview.
Yeah, for sure. And before we get started, I just want to give a big tip of the cap to Don and the team at Boise Dev. That kind of transparency and public records reporting is one of the highest forms of service that reporters can provide. And so I just wanted to give a kudos, and I'm so glad that you were able to highlight the reporting that they have done today. But yeah, the legislative...
I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely, Don. And please keep it up. But the legislative session starts Monday, and the big takeaway I had along with James and Ruth, who's on the program today, and some of our other friends, we met with the governor, we met with legislative leadership most of the morning yesterday at the Idaho State Capitol in anticipation of the legislative session beginning on Monday. And the big takeaway I had is that I see Republicans in the Idaho legislature looking to increase their strength and standing and power and authority through changes to the budget system this year that we can talk about, and through these election year bills that we're going to see. I wrote a story for the Idaho Capital Sun that came out late yesterday afternoon, kind of talking about two things that I'm going to be watching this year in mm-hmm. terms of forces acting on the legislative session. That's all these changes to the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee that sets the state budget. That's one of the things that I'm going to be watching for. And the second thing is going to be how the 2024 elections affect all of this. As many of your listeners know, as the reporters on the program today know, in 2024, we're going to have elections that affect almost all levels of government. County positions across Idaho, like county commissioner, are going to be up for election. Every seat and the Idaho legislature, all 105 seats, is going to be up for election. We've got the presidential election, every seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, and then I think one third of the seats in the U.S. Senate. So as we all know, 2024 is a big, important election year. But last year, after the redistricting process that was brought on by the 2020 mm-hmm. census, we saw a lot of new members of the Idaho legislature. We saw new leadership, new Speaker of the House, Mike Moyle, new majority leader, Megan Blanksma. A lot of things were new last year. This year, I think that group is kind of solidifying, is going to try and increase and consolidate power. And one of the first things I'm going to be watching for is JFAC when they meet on Tuesday. They're totally reconfiguring the budget hearing process in a couple of ways that we can talk about, but they're going to be shortening the public portion of their budget meetings. JFAC is a committee that meets every day, normally for about 3 hours, the last 10 or 12 years that I've been covering the legislative session. This year, they're going to shorten the public portion of that down to 90 minutes. And then for the other 90 minutes, the committee will work in small working groups, preparing budget bills in private behind closed doors. They say that's an effort to speed up the legislative session and to be more efficient now that they have more resources at their hands. They're also going to be totally changing the budget process itself. The two co-chairs of JFAC, which is Representative Wendy Horman, a Republican out of Idaho Falls, and Senator Scott Groh, a Republican out of Eagle, they said they're going to be implementing new spending caps this year that they're going to come up with. And one of the whole ideas is that they want to limit spending so they can keep money available for initiatives that legislators think of during the legislative session. And we heard a couple of legislators yesterday talk about, I'm thinking about specifically Senator Lori Den Hartog from Meridian and Representative Wendy Horman from Idaho Falls, talking about wanting to have more of an opportunity to get legislative priorities funded, to not just basically take the governor's budget request as marching orders, but to have their own initiatives and carve out space and time for them. And they're going to be looking at audits. Speaker of the House Mike Moyle talked about wanting to get Medicaid spending under control. And so I think we're going to see a lot of moves to cut spending, to reduce spending, and we're going to see some budget changes this year. And I just think about how big and important of a committee JFEC is, how big and important the state budget is. And when we talk about these changes, I think it'll be important for reporters to keep an eye on it because we haven't seen these kind of changes in a number of years. And so we don't know what the effect will be. But we do know that Republicans who have a supermajority are looking to control spending, looking to limit spending. We heard that time and again yesterday from leadership. And I think the budget committee is one of the areas that we'll see that. I can take a break, or we can talk about some of the bills that might surface. We can talk about some of the things that Governor Brad Little might mention during his State of the State address, which is Monday, which kicks off the whole session. But Jim, I'll take a break for a second and see where you want to go.
Well, what I want to do is I want to, in the next segment, Clark, I want to dive a little bit more into JFAC, because I'm quite curious on your thoughts on that and how they're restructuring that. But I would like to know about, and Ruth, jump in on this as well, because I know you were at the legislative preview. So anything that stood out for you as well, but Clark, is there anything we can expect to hear from Governor Little in his State of the State address on Monday? I know when Jimmy was on yesterday, he talked about Idaho Launch and how that's a big thing for the governor once again this year, but did he give any other insight into, you know, what his priorities are?
I think Jimmy is exactly right. I think Idaho Launch, which I don't know how much, I wasn't able to catch the program yesterday. I don't know how much Jimmy talked about it, but it's basically workforce training program that the legislature narrowly passed in 2023. It passed the House by the slimmest margin. If one legislator had changed their vote in the House, it would have failed on a tie vote. And so I think Governor Little and the Democrats have signaled that they want to support Launch. That's workforce training. That's $8,000 that's available for Idaho high school graduates and Idaho homeschool graduates who stay in Idaho for workforce training, which could be welding or auto repair or lineman or tech, or it could be a two-year community college program or a four-year program for any kind of in-demand job in Idaho. I think that a lot of the Republicans in the legislature, particularly in the House, have questions about Launch, and it's coming up for funding renewal this year. And so I think Governor Little will come out and talk about the record enrollment and interest in Launch, and about how they don't have enough funding available to provide money for all of the students who have applied. So I think there's going to be a strong defense of Launch. I think a couple of other things we could see the governor talk about are transportation funding. That's something that started a couple of years ago following the record budget surplus that we had in the state of Idaho. But Idaho has a massive backlog on road and bridge maintenance and safety. And a couple of years ago, the state started pouring surplus money into strategic investments, and transportation funding was one of those areas. I think that the governor may again make a push for some strategic investments in transportation projects, roads and bridges and things like that. That may be something the legislature goes along with, because I think there's an idea that that can help with property taxes if it's taking care of road and bridge maintenance that cities and counties won't have to do and won't have to raise taxes for. So I think that's one more thing that the governor may mention in his State of the State address. He was real careful yesterday not to give away all of the big talking points from his State of the State address, but he did make it very clear that education was going to be his top priority. Again, he talked about teacher salaries. There was a recent report that Kevin Richert and our friends at Idaho Education News did that talked about average teacher salary, median teacher salary, reaching $61,000 in the state of Idaho. Governor Little highlighted that. I suspect he might highlight that during the State of the State address as well. So education, the Launch program in particular, teacher salaries, and then I think transportation funding is another area that we may see the governor talk about on Monday.
Okay. Ruth, anything in particular stand out to you during the legislative preview yesterday?
Not to reiterate what Clark said, but I think the Idaho Launch program will be a big focus for Governor Little. Idaho Reports, which airs tonight at 8 p.m. on Idaho Public Television, if anyone wants to tune in. We have Representative Megan Blanksma, who's the House Majority Leader on, and she's been supportive of the Idaho Launch initiative. And she talked a little bit about there may need to be some tweaks to the program. A lot of legislators, I think, have concerns because the state does spend a tremendous amount of money to mm-hmm. fund four-year universities, BSU, ISU, so on and so forth. But mm-hmm. I think some legislators have concerns because we do spend a lot of money on universities. But the reality is that a lot of students, high school students, particularly young male students, don't often go on to university. And some of these programs like workforce development could be a better option for them that the state could support. So I think there will be this balance of trying to sell legislators on continuing to fund universities, of course, but also finding enough cash, I suppose, mm-hmm. or enough incentive to convince them that they should also fund this workforce development program that has been extremely popular with high school seniors.
So, Caleb, let's take a break from the legislature for a minute here in Idaho and fill us in before we go to break about the U.S. Forest Service. They have a proposal to conserve old growth forests and limit logging.
Yeah. So essentially, they're trying to help protect mature and old growth forests, which make up more than 60% of forest lands managed by the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. And these forests have been impacted greatly over the years from aggressive logging practices and also climate change, which is causing beetle outbreaks, wildfire spreading. So this new proposal, those federal agencies would partner with indigenous communities across the country to develop strategies on how to conserve these old growth forests. And I should note that old growth forests specifically account for 18% of the forest lands managed. Just to go a little deeper into what they provide to not only habitats, but also people, these forests help clean our air. They provide clean drinking water. They draw massive amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere and store that. And then they're obviously a habitat to a number of species across the country. So it's in the early stages. It's just a proposal. It's open for public comment through February 2nd. This is just something they're trying to make some efforts on. And I talked to someone with the Pew Charitable Trust, their conservation program, and he says in some places, the climate envelope is what he called it. These forests originally grew up in no longer exist. So that's really stressing these trees and making them less resistant to insects, disease, drought, and severe wildfires. So that's kind of the proposal in a nutshell.
Well, appreciate the update on that. So Clark, can you talk to us about these, you mentioned these significant changes coming up in JFAC this legislative session. What is your takeaway for that and these changes?
Well, I think that I don't know enough to know what it's going to mean. So I'm going to watch it closely. Mm-hmm. What the JFAC co-chairs are saying, what the legislators are saying is through more information available, through kind of going digital for the first time this year, which kind of moving over from reams and reams of paper budget reports to having everything available online and on electronic devices. They're saying they have more information available, they can be more efficient with their time, and they can prevent all of the budget bills from backing up hundreds of bills deep at the end of the session, which absolutely happens every year. Ruth and I and Jimmy will all be sitting there watching it with Melissa Davlin, and it'll be budget bill after budget bill after budget bill. Legislators are saying this year they can be more efficient. They can start writing budgets earlier and get the process mm-hmm. moving earlier so it doesn't jam up at the end. That's what they're saying their goal is. They're also talking about reducing spending overall and carving out room, like I said, for initiatives that come out of the legislative session from legislators themselves. They're also going to cut the budgets in half. So they're going to take last year's budget, is my understanding, and move that forward for a vote at the beginning of the legislative session and call that a maintenance budget, and then later in the year, look at the requests for new spending, for increases, for replacements, for line items, and do that separately later in the year. I just haven't seen this play out before, and so I don't know what it's going to mean. Their goal is more efficiency and reining in spending, which means cutting and reducing spending. But it's something that I'm going to watch closely this year, and I know the other reporters covering the State House will be following it and reporting on it as well, Gemma.
Yeah, I really appreciate that update. And folks, read Clark's article on this that just came out today at the Idaho Capital Sun. It really goes more in depth. So, Caleb, some areas of the West, as we know, are continuing to deal with low water levels. I mean, there are some areas that are dealing with drought. With that said, what are some Mountain West states doing to cut back on water usage? And this has to do with, I guess, what, paying farmers?
Yeah, Nevada has long been trying to kind of tackle the issue of groundwater overuse and overpumping. So they're putting some money into it. They're using $25 million in federal funds to pay farmers to cut back, essentially. So the pilot program is kind of pioneering a way for the state to buy, or actually, I should back up. The state is partnering with some water agencies and conservation groups. They're kind of facilitating these efforts. And what they'll do is they'll pay farmers to stop irrigating certain areas to reduce their groundwater pumping through the acquisition and ultimate retirement of the right to pump that groundwater. So they're working with farmers and ranchers who have these rights that they're interested in selling, and then they'll acquire those rights and ultimately take them off the books. And this is something that they're kind of, again, like I was saying with the Forest Service proposal, they're in the early stages of this. They're forming meetings and getting kind of feedback from farmers and ranchers to kind of see what kind of buy-in they have, no pun intended. So yeah, we'll see how much this actually makes a dent in the overuse, because groundwater has been largely stitched in Northern Nevada's economy for almost a century now. It's tied to agriculture, like I mentioned, drinking water supplies. There's a lot of massive gold mines that rely on groundwater. I think it's just reaching a stage where they need to make some kind of drastic action to see some changes happen.
Don, before we go to break, tell us about what's going on up in McCall. There's a shop that's battling with City Hall, and it has to do with their roof.
Yeah, it kind of depends on what you think looks nice on a building.
I guess so.
The owners of the Lake Town Shore Shop in McCall. This is Autumn Robertson's reporting, who covers McCall for us. They took over a building downtown where they used to have McCall Pet Outfitters and Supply in it, and they put water skis on the roof, and they didn't get a permit for that. And later, the McCall Design Review, McCall Planning and Zoning said, yeah, you can't do that. We've got some design and safety concerns. They actually said they liked how it looked, but didn't get permission. So sometimes those things go a little awry. There were a lot of supportive comments, and the owner now says he's going to fight on, telling Autumn that they think it's a cool addition to downtown. They ran into the code issues, and they're gonna keep fighting. It's been really popular, and the comments that we've seen, people are like, it's fine. It's not necessarily the earth tones and natural materials that the code calls for, but maybe this should be okay. McCall is a ski town, a water and snow skiing kind of a town. And so we'll see where this goes as it goes through the appeals process.
So Don, some potential significant growth coming along Interstate 84 near 10 Mile.
Yeah, this is a potentially massive project. Our Sydney Kid found this right before the Christmas holiday and was rearing to go to report it and break it on Tuesday after the holiday. Ball Ventures Adler Industrial, Ball Ventures, Allquist, and a new firm have come together to develop just a big old piece of property. It's 200 acres at the corner of 10 Mile and 94. Help you picture this. If you've been to that interchange, you know, as you drive out towards Nampa and you look towards the right, there's all those office buildings that BBA development did. And on the other side of 10 Mile, it's a very large open field that's been used for agricultural uses for generations. The interesting thing here to me is that the founder of CenterCal, his name is Fred Bruning, has left CenterCal and started a new firm called Elevated Property Company. And if you're like, CenterCal, why does that ring a bell? That's the company behind the Village at Meridian. And so this is the guy that helped head up the team that did the Village. This project is very early in the conceptual phases, but would include big box retail, some smaller retail spaces, lots of multifamily, some office buildings, and even some light industrial on the site. And you know, one thing, since we published a story that has gotten a lot of attention on social media channels, Twitter, Reddit, Facebook, et cetera, is there's a lot of parking here. I've tried to caution people that this is really early. We don't know what this is going to look like, but the kind of drawing that they provided us does show significant amounts of parking. And so we're going to see how that comes together, what form this takes. I've kind of heard some interesting things about potential tenants out there. I won't say anything more just yet, but we'll be following this and trying to see how this comes together. But boy, the Village itself, this was Sydney's story, but I took some time to do the math on how big the Village was, and now I forget. But it's like almost 2.5 times in total land size bigger than the Village. So you kind of picture that and you go, that's a lot. We'll see how this goes. It hasn't formally been applied for yet, but we expect to see that in coming months.
And Don, I want to wrap up today with some news about the passing of Big Jack Armstrong. Yeah. I know some people may not recognize the name, but for those of us who've been here for a long time, he was a legend in Boise broadcasting. So, and I know you wrote a really nice story about him.
Yeah, Big Jack, just a really nice guy. I will say, when I was very little, so. Like kindergarten, first grade, Big Jack lived next door to me and parked the KF95 van out there. And I just thought that was the neatest thing. I worked for his brother, Doug Armstrong, for almost 20 years at Channel 7. And Big Jack was a radio personality, and he was on KF95, which was like the main pop station in the 80s and 90s here. Kind of like the Kiss FM of its day. Honestly, when radio was, especially pop radio, was a much bigger deal. And then in the late 90s and 2000s, your listeners are probably familiar with him on Cool Oldies 104.3, and he did the mornings there. And he was a guy that was just, he was everywhere, a big personality, and you listen to him on the radio, and he was fun to listen to. He did, I remember years and years ago, he did a fundraiser where he sat in every seat at what was then called the Pavilion. He hung from a car, suspended from a crane for another fundraiser. He was always out and about. He had a separate company that organized Northwest Motor Fest and the Father's Day car show. And he was big in the car scene. And beyond that, he was just the nicest guy. And several people commented, you know, it's common when people die for people to say nice things. Hopefully somebody says something nice when I leave this earth. nobody at Boise State probably, but, it's really true. He was a nice person who would shake your hand and make you feel like you were the most important person in the world. He had a stroke in 2013 and retired to Lewiston and died of a heart attack shortly before the new year. This story, well,
I've got to
a
wrap
lot of
you
people
up.
Read it.
I've got to,
yep, a lot of people
yeah,
read
and I've got,
it.
And I've got to wrap you up, Don. So folks, read the story on Boise Dev if you'd like to know more. Big thank you to all of our reporter roundtable. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it.
Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to Life Kit from NPR.